You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a medical historian about the 1894 smallpox riots in Milwaukee and why some public health efforts turn out to be unsuccessful. First, the coronavirus pandemic has put extra strain on food assistance organizations like food banks and food pantries. Food supplies are down while demand is up. So how are the groups that help people with food insecurity holding up? Patty Habeck is president and CEO of Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, which operates food banks around Milwaukee and the Fox Valley. Patty, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And Stephanie Young-Dorfman is executive director of Feeding Wisconsin, which is the statewide association of Feeding America food banks. Stephanie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Patty, let's start with you. Since Wisconsin began to feel the effects of this pandemic, health-wise and in terms of the economy, what has changed for you and other organizations that try to help meet food needs?
Well, I think just like everybody else, the pandemic really made us look at processes and how we are serving the communities and change that on a dime. Overnight, we saw a massive increase in the number of in the amount of demand on our food banks to serve food pantries and communities around the eastern side of Wisconsin. We also saw the type of food that people were accessing change suddenly. There was a strong increase in demand for shelf stable products, or you know, of course, everybody wants the fresh and healthy products and the dairy and the meat, but suddenly the shelf-stable products, the things that people would want to put in their shelves and make sure they had enough to last a longer period of time, really became in demand. So we scrambled around to make sure that despite disruptions in the supply chain, we were able to keep as much of all of those products in stock so that as demand rose, we were able to meet the needs.
And Stephanie, Patty's working in the eastern part of the state. Is it a similar story all over Wisconsin?
Yep, it is. So while we're seeing the supply chain disruptions happening, our food banks are seeing an increase of demand. While we're not able to supply the same amount of specific items that are being demanded, our food banks have done a great job of providing the desired amount of food based on the number of households that our network is serving. So keeping up as best we can, and our food banks are continuing to do what they do best, make sure that we can source food, nutritious food, to get to those who need it.
And Patty, we've seen a story around the country, really, where as people need more food, supply chains are disrupted and some of the traditional customers for food, like the restaurant industry and schools, don't need it. So farmers don't know what to do with some of their produce. Are you finding ways to creatively close that loop?
Yeah, so that's been a really interesting challenge and a fun problem to work on, even though it has a real our work has real important results. And so what we've been doing is really getting creative in terms of trying to figure out if we could take in product that was previously going into food service and repackage or relabel products so that we could repurpose that into household, so that households can take advantage of that. So sometimes that might mean we take large cuts of meat that were previously going into food service and seeing if we could partner with a local meat cutter and see if they will cut it down and package and label it for individual family size use. Or we recently got an outreach from a very large food service vendor, a hospitality vendor actually, and they had so much product available, we couldn't use any of it for family use, but we didn't want it to go to waste either. So we were able to partner in our Milwaukee location with about 70 different restaurants who are willing to take in that product, divide it up, they're cooking it down into meals and then packaging the meals, and we're helping to make sure we distribute that around the area. So getting very, very creative with the resources that are out there. We are working very hard to make sure that nothing goes to waste.
Now, Stephanie, some people, thanks to job loss right now, unexpected job loss, furloughs, things like that, might be needing food assistance, maybe for the first time in their lives. What would you say to them about exploring the various resources that are out there and available to them?
Yeah, absolutely. Our food pantries have definitely seen that. We also have a statewide food share outreach helpline that is taking in calls. We're seeing great increases of need in both of those spaces. And we are tracking a great number of households that are new to this experience of food insecurity. So I would say to them, my suggestion to them is to know that our food banks, our food pantries are out there ready to serve. There's also great support in Food Share and WIC in our state. And I would tell them they're not alone right now, especially. This is unfortunately a very normalizing experience that folks are going through as they're experiencing hunger for the first time, making really tough trade-offs in their lives as they're missing their first or second paychecks to understand how they can manage their own budget to pay rent, pay utilities, pay for medication. And oftentimes food is the most flexible budget category that they have, and oftentimes a sacrifice. So know that you can call 211 to receive information about your local pantry near you, and also reach out for support if you're interested in learning more about food share benefits, which have some important flexibilities right now and increased benefit allotments to help folks in this especially trying time.
Talking to Patty Habeck and Stephanie Young Dorfman with Feeding America here in Wisconsin, looking at how food banks are responding to an increase in demand and some disruption of supply in the food that they provide. Patty, I imagine a lot of people who are able to right now want to help out if they can, want to make donations to help keep the food flowing here. Right now, given where we are, what is the best way for members of the public to help out?
So typically my answer to that would be food funds or friends to either provide food, provide dollars, or to volunteer. Right now, because of the situation that we're in and social distancing, volunteering while we're still doing it is a lot more narrow of a category. So the best way to help out, quite honestly, right now is to look to your local food bank or your food pantries and look to financial support. What each food pantry needs are very different from each other. Some might be getting a lot of fresh produce from a local farmer, but they need to purchase milk, something along that line. So dollars are most flexible. And then food banks, like mine, like the other ones across the state, what we do is we're able to pull together all of those dollars and purchase at scale with manufacturers that are offering great prices right now and the ability to bring in the product that we actually need right now. Now more than ever, it's really dollars more than anything. And that is the biggest help that we can get right now to make sure that people are able to receive the food that they need.
And Stephanie, what if I'm somebody in the food supply chain, anywhere from a farmer or a food processor or somebody who delivers food to, you know, the restaurants that aren't running at full tilt right now? And I'm thinking, hey, I've got some supply. I want to connect it here. How can they help?
Yeah, please reach out for both an individual or a possible processor, farmer, donor. Go to our website, feedingwi.org, and you can connect either to your local food bank or connect to myself, please. We, in this time, have built some strong relationships with DACCAP, the Department of Ag Trade Consumer and Consumer Protection, and also our Wisconsin dairy farmers. We are doing more than ever before to connect to our local Wisconsin egg products to move that nutritious food to our food bank network and to continue to support getting farmers paid and processors paid to keep them afloat during these tough times. Really, this has given us great opportunities to strengthen those win-win partnerships that are going to keep us going through this long haul ahead.
And one of those partnerships, Patty, did I read this right? The Milwaukee Bucks helping out with food that people would have been eating in their stands had there been an NBA season going on?
That is. That's been a really that was a great phone call. I was actually talking to Coach Bud this morning, too, about his personal donations to keep hunger relief systems strong. But absolutely, the Bucks donated all the food that was in their facilities that would have been making a lot of people happy if they were able to watch the games. Since they couldn't, they moved it right into the hunger relief system, and we're moving it to make sure it reaches people's plates as quickly as possible.
And Stephanie, as we wrap up, remind us how people in need of various kinds of food assistance can find it in their area.
Yeah, we work very closely with the United Way Network. 211 is a number that you can dial from any phone in any county and be connected to a community resource hotline. They will connect you to one of our food pantries so you can get connected with food and also connect you to other community resources in your area.
All right, Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Patty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity.
We've been talking to Patty Habeck, President and CEO of Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, and Stephanie Young-Dorfman, Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. We talked to them today about the state of food banks in Wisconsin and how people can help out. We've got a link, by the way, to their website at WPR.org/Central Time. You can find local food pantries that way as well, and how to help out if you're able. Coming up, we'll learn about a time in Milwaukee history where a public health crisis caused intense backlash and find out what we can learn from it in our response now to the coronavirus. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, House Democrats are putting out a new emergency relief bill aimed at helping people get through the coronavirus pandemic. We'll find out what's in the $3 trillion proposal and why it's getting pushback from Republicans and some Democrats. First, the latest Marquette poll shows a majority of Wisconsinites still support the state's stay-at-home order, but that support is slipping and starting to show a partisan divide. That comes after protests at the Capitol last month calling on lawmakers to reopen the state and its economy. This is not the first time public health measures have sparked a backlash here in the state. Judith Walzer-Levitt is a professor emerita in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Her research is included in a new piece from WisContext that looks at the 1894 smallpox riots in Milwaukee and some of the public health lessons to come out of it. She's the author of multiple books, including one on this topic called The Healthiest City, Milwaukee, and the Politics of Health Reform. Judith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Well, can you set the stage for us? 1894, signs of smallpox breaking out in Milwaukee. Tell us what we were starting to see there.
Okay. Well, let me say that smallpox was a disease that hit American cities, and Milwaukee was one of them, multiple times in the 19th century. And each time, health departments gained in stature, authority, and powers as a result of the epidemic, because people feared it and was willing to, for example, build an isolation hospital and do other fairly expensive things to help further public health. So in 1984, when smallpox came, I think the health department and people who knew the story thought that the same thing would happen. But instead, riots broke out in the streets and lasted for about a month in the streets of especially the 11th Ward and the 14th Ward on the south side. And so I was very interested to find out why, what was different about this outbreak, and to see if we could learn something from it. So a couple things were different, and a couple things were exactly the same. Now, let me first talk about the ones that were the same. The health commissioner immediately started to isolate people who were sick, which was a very standard procedure, and to vaccinate those who were in contact with the sick people or who had not been vaccinated before. So he launched a vaccination campaign and isolation campaign. And he thought that was just standard procedure, and it was, and he thought everything would be fine. But what he learned was that people on the South Side, and that meant especially immigrant communities, Polish and German, didn't like what he said. And partly it was because he came forcibly to remove their children to the isolation hospital, whereas in other parts of the city, the white native-born parts of the city, he was not forcibly removing children from their families, but was letting them isolate at home. So immediately, the people on the South Side thought that things were not equitable and that they were being discriminated against, and they resisted. So when the ambulance came to take their children, the women especially were out on the streets refusing to allow their children to be taken. Now, some were taken forcibly, but women were out there with salt and pepper, boiling water, baseball bats, anything at hand, that is domestic weapons, to try to resist the health department authorities. So it was a very bad scene in the sense that the disease was probably more widely transmitted because of these riots, but it definitely taught people that fairness and honesty with the people was very important to successful public health.
Right. This perception at reality, it sounds like actually that there were haves and have-nots, and they were being treated very differently by public health authorities. It sounds like a key part of this story.
Exactly. You have it exactly right. And I think that's why, I mean, a lot of the immigrants came to this country thinking that they would be not the subject of government authority or adverse government authority. And here were people in uniform coming to take their children away. It couldn't have been a worse perception. And as you say, perception and reality, they were in fact taking children. And the isolation hospital, which was also located on the south side, they thought was a pest house where people would go to die, not where people would go to get better, which was actually probably not the case by 1894. They had just renovated the hospital, but it was still a pretty dangerous place, and they didn't want their children to have to go there.
Another part of the story is you mentioned the vaccine. Now, smallpox ultimately eradicated by vaccine, and I'm glad of that, a nasty disease. What were efforts like to get more people to be vaccinated? What was the resistance to that like in this 1894 outbreak in Milwaukee?
Well, vaccination, you know, it's a very interesting point, because if we're all saying that if we had a vaccine for COVID-19, everything would be great. And they had a vaccine for smallpox in 1894, and everything wasn't great. So I think we have to pay attention to that. It was partly that it was unequally administered. That is, the health department tried to force it on the poorer sections of the city and not on the rich, who came forward more voluntarily. There was also a very strong anti-vaccination movement in the 19th century that reared its head during this outbreak, and that tried to convince people that vaccines were dangerous. They could cause other diseases, they could cause infection, they could cause a reaction that might be an adverse reaction, not the positive one you're looking for. And so there was a lot of fear around that. And it's partly a question of how information is transmitted, and not just the information itself. So I also studied an outbreak of smallpox in New York City in 1947, which also had vaccination and isolation as the prime messages from the health department, and yet they were able to voluntarily vaccinate 6,350,000 New Yorkers within a period of weeks. So, and the reason they were able to do it and Milwaukee wasn't, I think, does have to do with how they gave the information, how they worked in cooperation with community groups, with the various foreign language newspapers, and really made an effort to show how fair they were distributing the vaccine and the other policies. Whereas in Milwaukee, Milwaukee had a new health commissioner. And he at one point said, when he was being interviewed, "I'm only trying to execute the law here, and I'll break heads if I have to do it." And that was sort of his response. It had lack of compassion, complete lack of compassion, and made people not trust him. And that was part of the reason trust is so important to public health work. And to get trust, you have to be honest. You have to be equitable, and you have to be informative in a way that people can actually hear the message, if it's in their language, for example, but also hear it in terms of that you are acting for their good, for the public's health, not misusing your power and authority.
Talking to Judith Walzer-Levitt, author of the book The Healthiest City, Milwaukee and the Politics of Health Reform, looking at an 1894 smallpox outbreak in Milwaukee and public health lessons learned from it. And let's get to those lessons, because you, in your book, I think, talk about Milwaukee over the half century after this outbreak as, in some ways, a model American city when it came to public health. What did they change?
That's right. I call the book The Healthiest City because Milwaukee won a health contest so much that they were actually had to be taken off the list so that other cities could have a chance. And it was a contest that the U.S. Public Health Service ran to compare various cities in America in the 1920s and 1930s. And Milwaukee won every time until they put Milwaukee on an honor roll and said they couldn't compete anymore because it was too good. Now, they were looking at measures of infant mortality, general mortality, sanitation, sewerage systems, water systems, and those were the things that Milwaukee had really worked very hard on over the course of the last part of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. They put a lot of money into building good sewage systems, good water systems, filtering the water, making sure that Milwaukee could be a sanitary place that would not be a place where infectious diseases could be easily transmitted environmentally. And so Milwaukee paid a lot of attention to that. The 1894 epidemic was really the only example where they really moved backward in terms of getting positive health reform efforts in place. And so really from 1867, when the health department is founded, until the 1930s, when it was taken off the honor roll, was put on an honor roll and taken out of the competition to be the healthiest city in America, Milwaukee put a lot of money into health care. And that was even furthered in 1910 when the socialists won the mayoralty and the majority in the Common Council, because one of their planks in the platform that on which they won was free health care for all Milwaukeeans. Now, that never came to be. The socialists didn't stay in power, except for the mayor stayed for a good half of the century, but the Common Council never had a socialist majority anymore. But health reform continued to be something that was valued by almost everybody in Milwaukee, and politicians were willing to put money into it and to pay attention to the health of the whole city, not just a part of it. And it really paid off. And Milwaukee was really a terrific place to live in terms of health in the first half of the 19th century. And unfortunately, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, money in public health infrastructure really started decreasing a lot in the late part of the 20th century and into the 21st century, and Milwaukee has now been among the worst on many public health indices today. But for a good long time, public health was a political priority as well as a health priority, and it showed.
We'll leave it there for now. Judith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Judith Walzer-Levitt, Professor Emerita at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She's with us today to talk about the 1894 smallpox riots in Milwaukee and what they can teach us about what works and doesn't work in response to a public health crisis. You can find more online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, House Democrats are out with a new stimulus bill to give support to businesses and state governments during the pandemic. It's getting pushback from the right and some on the left. We'll find out more during a look at the week in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany is set to be Wisconsin's newest member of Congress. We'll talk about what happened last night in the special election in the 7th Congressional District. First, we take a look at this week's news in national politics. The White House is taking more safety measures after two staffers tested positive for COVID-19. The Joe Biden campaign is reportedly narrowing down its search for a running mate. And House Democrats are out with a $3 trillion emergency relief bill to help businesses, individuals, and state and local governments affected by the pandemic. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says acting now would save money in the long run.
The low interest rate and the prospect of access to credit has bolstered the stock market. We intend to use those low interest rates to bolster the American people. We must think big for the people now, because if we don't, it will cost more in lives and livelihood later.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think another stimulus package is needed? What would you want to see the money going toward? Is there something Congress could do that would help you right now, or your family, or your business, or your workplace? Or should we hit pause on big spending bills for the moment? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. Scott, good to have you back with us.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, before we get into the contents of this proposal from House Democrats, let's key in on the who here. This is House Democrats. Past things have been negotiated by various parties and players. Who's this one coming from?
That's exactly right. You know, with Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans saying we need to hit the pause button and allow the money that's already been allocated to sort of take effect and see what the results are, Democrats and Nancy Pelosi specifically are seeing this as an opportunity to show the American people that they are looking out for them during this pandemic. And so essentially they are moving forward. A vote scheduled for Friday on a $3 trillion package, what they're calling the HEROES Act. And obviously there was a lot of thought into how to brand this to the American people. And they said, you know, look, the bulk of this is money, $1 trillion for state and local governments, which fund people like policemen and firefighters and first responders. And so let's really focus on, calling this and branding this the HEROES Act. And that's something they believe will resonate with the American people.
That support, as you say, for state and local government's a big part of this. That's not a slam dunk with everybody, though. What have some objections been to the idea of big federal relief for state and local governments?
Well, there's already been four major packages, right? More than $2 trillion worth of spending that's already out the door that Congress has passed, that Trump has signed into law. And so that's really the argument that you're hearing from Republicans, is that we need to see how this money is all working out before we rush to pass another big spending bill. I think most people agree something else will be needed heading into this summer as the deaths continue to mount and as the cases continue to rise and more millions of Americans are on these are getting unemployment benefits, but that's really the big division that you're seeing between Democrats and Republicans right now, is how quickly to move on this next tranche of spending.
And there have been objections also, and you've looked at this, I think, Scott, from some Democrats about the bill. What are we hearing mostly from the left side of the party?
Yeah, there has been some grumbling from some of the progressive leaders, specifically Mark Pocan and Pramila Jayapal, Mark Pocan being from Wisconsin and Jayapal from Washington State. These are the two leaders of the Progressive Caucus who sent a letter to the leadership last night asking Pelosi to hit the pause button, to postpone the Friday vote, give lawmakers a few more days to get through this 800-page bill, a massive bill that we were pouring through last night, and also try to get some of their more progressive policies included. There is a lot in there for progressives to like. There's additional relief checks, $1,200 relief checks. Some Americans have already gotten their first relief check. Well, this would propose another $1,200 relief check per person, $2,400 per couple, and up to $6,000 for larger families. And so there are a lot of priorities that folks on the left will like, but I think they're still fighting even at this last minute to try to get more priorities in there.
It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Scott Wong is with us from The Hill. Right now, we're talking about a proposal from House Democrats, another big economic recovery package there. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see coming out of Congress and the president when it comes to economic recovery efforts? Do you think we've spent enough already? Want to wait and see how it works, or is more needed and quickly? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go to your calls now. Alan is with us in Madison. Alan, hello.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question about another huge spending bill is I learned that all this borrowing really causes inflation. So wouldn't the spending bill be very inflationary?
Alan, thanks for the call. Scott, that's usually a concern raised when we have big federal borrowing and spending. Is that something, the risk of inflation, people are talking about in Washington right now?
Ooh, that's a tough question for me to answer. I'm far from an economist. I think what's been interesting in this whole debate, as we've seen these four tranches of spending go out the door in the last couple months, is that, one of those bills was a $2 trillion bill, the largest that we've ever seen Congress pass in history. And the United States Senate, controlled by Republicans, did that bill on a voice vote, meaning a lot of members were not even present. They did it by unanimous consent. And so in the past, you know, gosh, in past years, we would have seen Republicans objecting to these massive spending bills. And just given the severity of this problem and also the fears of people gathering together in the Capitol, you're seeing a lot of money go out the door under Republican leadership, certainly under the leadership of Mitch McConnell and President Trump in the White House. So that's been something sort of eye-opening in the past. We, you know, especially after this last decade of all this talk we've heard from the Tea Party of trying to cut back on the federal spending, to see these trillions of dollars go out the door in such an easy fashion has really been quite shocking.
Thanks, Alan, for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to check out some other parts of this bill. Scott, as you mentioned, a lot would be there for local and state governments, another round of direct checks to people. Now, how about small businesses? Two of the past things, we had that Paycheck Protection Program. It ran out of money. They put in more money. I understand that's running out. Is there more now in this House proposal?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd have to double check and see if there's more money for small businesses. I know there has been enormous concerns with how that Paycheck Protection Program has been implemented. You've seen the same headlines I've been reading. I mean, there have been enormous problems with just connecting the funding with the right small businesses. You've seen some major corporations be able to secure that money ahead of sort of mom and pop businesses that are going out of business. A lot of people complaining that they couldn't even get in line or get onto the website to apply for some of that money. I know they've started to work out some of the kinks, and obviously, you know, the Small Business Administration is one of the smaller federal agencies, and all of a sudden they were at the center of this hurricane and completely inundated and over their heads when it came to trying to process all of these applications. So I think what the Democrats had been talking about and had been proposing were some improvements to that PPP program. And so, you know, hopefully things are going to start working a lot smoother going forward. But the funding issue had been a problem in terms of connecting the money with the businesses in order to save some of those businesses, which are a lot of them are under threat of going out of business.
Before we move on from this House package, Scott, let's talk a little bit about the hows and whens here. We had Wisconsin Republican Representative Mike Gallagher on the show earlier this week. He expressed some frustration with the slow pace of bringing the House back into session, saying, in effect, hey, the Senate, they were able to get back to work. Why can't we? What's just going on in the doings of the House right now?
Yeah, when you look at the Capitol as a whole, the Senate is back at work. Now, the Senate's controlled by Republicans and Mitch McConnell. They have decided that they are going to be working through this crisis. They want to show the American people that, you know, if other essential workers at hospitals and police officers and firefighters are having to go and folks at grocery stores are having to go into work every day, then the United States Congress should be doing the same. And so that's been sort of the tact of Republicans in the Senate. The Democrats obviously control the other chamber, the House of Representatives, and they've been much more hesitant and cautious, especially since you've seen a number of cases of COVID-19 affect some of their members. At least six House lawmakers have been infected by COVID-19. All have since recovered, but they're, you know, there are more members of the House of Representatives. There's 435. That means all of those people plus all the staffers and the reporters. And it gets to be a much more crowded environment than over in the Senate, where you can sort of socially distance much better than you could in the House. And so Republicans are anxious to call the House back into session. They want to show the American people that they're working. Democrats on Friday will be taking up a measure in addition to this big $1 trillion package that would allow them to vote by proxy. And what that means real quickly is, you know, they could be back in Wisconsin or Washington State and have a member on the floor vote on their behalf. enough for future, future Corona packages like this one. So far, we haven't seen that vote. It looks like it's going to be a party line vote with Democrats supporting that process. Republicans are saying we really need to be here in person and show the American people that we're working.
Let's bring on one more caller before we move on from the topic. Rod is with us in Sun Prairie. Rod, hi.
Hey, how you doing? This thing about giving out more money, and in some cases, I don't have a problem with it. There's people that need it. But my mother is 89 years old, and she still hasn't received the $1,200 first round check. My wife and I received ours a couple of weeks after they started issuing them because we had direct deposit. My mother doesn't. She's old school for this type of thing. And then on top of the deal, we also got a check in the mail several weeks ago that was from my mother-in-law. She's been dead for 2 years. Now, I think they need to get their act together and start working for us and paying attention to what's going on instead of worry about saving their jobs and their paychecks and their cushy benefits when they leave Congress.
Rod, thanks for the call. Some confusion going on still, Rod says, over the last round of individual payouts. Is there a thought that another round might go more smoothly?
Well, that's very interesting how the caller was describing these stimulus checks going out to his family or not going out in some cases, and in some cases going to deceased people. We have heard those same concerns. In fact, some lawmakers have introduced legislation that would try to prevent checks from going to waste and fraud, in particular to deceased people. It just speaks to the magnitude of this problem. I think the Congresses and the leaders in Washington, their thinking was because of the severity of halting the economy all at once, that it was important to get the money out the door, and on the back end of it, they would try to address the fraud, waste, and abuse. And you're seeing some of those oversight efforts ramp up right now. But because, they were so concerned about people being able to keep a roof over their head or to keep food on the table, they wanted the money out the door ASAP. And of course, when you do that, you are going to have a lot of errors, as we have seen and that your caller has alluded to just now.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, and our weekly look at the latest news in national politics coming up. We'll take a look at some presidential politics. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at the week in Washington. Scott, our presidential race just about filled out here. It looks like it's Trump and Pence versus Biden and TBD. Let's look at that player to be named later now. What is the latest talk about who Joe Biden might pick as a running mate?
Well, what we know so far is that he's going to pick a woman. He's made that pretty clear in multiple interviews, and I think it'd be really hard to walk that back at this point just because of the amount of excitement that Democrats have that there will be a woman on this ticket. There has been actually quite a bit of buzz about Governor Cuomo up in New York just because of his daily televised performances on press conferences on the coronavirus. But I really think it's going to come down to just a handful of women. Specifically right now, leading the pack has got to be Kamala Harris. Amy Parnes, a colleague, and I did a piece yesterday about talking to a number, nearly two dozen strategists in the Democratic Party who all were pointing to Kamala Harris. She just checks a lot of boxes. She's been through, like the other two senators, Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar, she's been through a presidential campaign. So there's a certain amount of vetting already that's taken place. And, she's all three of those women certainly could be president on day one. But Kamala Harris, she's an African-American woman. She's a big star in the party. She checks a lot of boxes, and so I think right now we're looking at Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and perhaps Amy Klobuchar.
Some people, and I think you talked about this in your piece, have pointed towards some testy exchanges during the presidential debates when Senator Kamala Harris was still in the race. Bygones, it sounds like, could be bygones, though.
Yeah, if you remember in one of the debates, she brought up some busing issues that had sort of haunted Biden in the past, and the Biden camp was not too thrilled about that. You know, Kamala Harris has a little bit of baggage herself in that she is an ex-prosecutor. She came up as a San Francisco district attorney when actually Gavin Newsom was mayor there. She was the attorney general of California and then was catapulted to the United States Senate. And that would all be fine in a different era, but, you know, there are a number of progressives and black activists who have not taken well to that history, you know, in California. Sort of that tough law enforcement background doesn't play well with the liberal base. There's been a disproportionate number of African Americans incarcerated in California, some of that happening under Kamala Harris's watch as Attorney General. And so that's going to be something that she, and if the Biden team picks her, will have to wrestle with going forward.
On a related note, within the Democratic Party, we have former Vice President Biden and Senator and former campaign opponent Bernie Sanders naming members to these committees, these unity committees in the Democratic Party. What's this all about?
Yeah, you really have seen Joe Biden and his top rival in the presidential campaign, Bernie Sanders, work pretty well together. You know, they served briefly in the Senate. They were pretty friendly on the campaign trail. They seem like there is a relationship there. And obviously, Joe Biden needs to turn out the liberal base, which in large part has backed Bernie Sanders in the primary. And so there's been a lot of Biden outreach efforts. And so this is Biden extending the olive leaf to Bernie and saying, help me choose some people to represent the platform that we are going to have on this quote-unquote unity ticket going forward. One of those key members is AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who Bernie has nominated for Biden's climate committee. And obviously climate change has been a huge part of her platform. Karen Bass, the Congressional Black Caucus leader, will co-chair Biden's economic team. There's a handful of, and AOC will be working with former Secretary of State John Kerry on climate. So there's several big names, including a lot of progressives that had been aligned with Bernie Sanders.
In our last couple of minutes, Scott, let's turn to the White House and concerns about a couple of staff members there testing positive for COVID-19. How has this shaken up daily operations in the White House?
Well, it's been a little bit of a shock because President Trump and the top White House officials have really been pushing on this idea of reopening the economy. And so when you're trying to push that message and you start to have members of your own team, in some cases high-profile members like Vice President Mike Pence's press secretary, Katie Miller, she's married to, of course, Stephen Miller, one of the top advisors and speechwriters for President Trump, that starts to raise some concerns. And so that juxtaposition has been difficult, I think, for this White House to grapple with. The other person who tested positive was President Trump's personal valet, somebody with, you know, some proximity to the president. So these are people that are interacting with top officials. These are people that you see. I mean, there's photographic evidence, so you pretty much know everyone who Katie Miller has been talking to, a lot of reporters, a lot of top staff, the vice president himself. So now you have, you know, members of the president's coronavirus task force, including Dr. Fauci, self-quarantining just as precaution. So it's crippled the White House team at a time when they've tried to show this image of strength and this image of economic recovery and getting back to normal. And it's been a challenge for them.
Scott, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime, Rob. Thank you.
We've been talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He joined us for our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. We do this every week, this time on Wednesday. Also yesterday in the Capitol, the Senate was busy hearing from top medical experts like Dr. Anthony Fauci. As Scott just mentioned, he's partially quarantining, but he testified remotely. He talked about the administration response to the COVID-19 pandemic. A little later today, we're going to talk to a health policy reporter about what we heard in that testimony and then what it could mean for the weeks and even months ahead. A lot of information there for about what the White House was recommending in terms of state and local governments reopening businesses and their local economy and what that can mean for Wisconsin and states around the country as they weigh their options. Again, that look at Dr. Fauci's testimony before the U.S. Senate, that's coming up in about half an hour here on Central Time. Here on Central Time, we're always on the lookout for weird animal stories, and this one could be the greatest of all time, at least in acronym terms. One, the story is a suburban neighborhood in East San Jose, California, saw a lot of street traffic yesterday evening, only the traffic was goats. Over 200 goats were on duty helping to clear brush to help prevent the spread of wildfires. Now, apparently goats are really good for this kind of work. Sometimes if you're using a tractor or a lawnmower, it can hit a rock that sets off sparks and it can start fires. So that's one point in favor of the goats. On the other hand, lawnmowers don't get bored, break out of their enclosures, and go stampeding through the streets of local suburban communities. That's what the goats did yesterday, 200 of them. A video online shows the goats rushing around, eating what look like roses and other shrubs, and generally having a good time until their owner starts herding them back home. As reported in the San Jose Mercury News, quote, they also left a conspicuous trail of droppings. It's not a sentence your average reporter gets to write very often. The person who took the video described it as total chaos. Looked like the goats actually kind of knew what they were doing and where they were going, though. So, I don't know. Would have been cool to see. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.